Hello and thanks once again for taking the time to download and listen to our podcast from CelticUnderground.net. I'm Harry Brady and this is podcast number 236. I'm sure it hasn't escaped your notice, but we have a rather big game coming up this week against Inter Milan on Thursday. A name famous from our history, obviously, with 67 and then the failed European Cup semi-final in 72. So who better to discuss this forthcoming game and set it in the context of that history than our own St Anthony with Pat Woods. Before we get on to that chat between Saint and Pat, on Thursday I was fortunate enough to be with the Celtic FC Foundation when they launched their three-year development programme in the East End of London. Charles McGrew was there on hand as Tony Hamilton announced a three-year charitable sports programme in partnership with the Big Lottery Fund, Five Star Active and Poplar Harker Housing Association, who are based in Tower Hamlets. The programme sees the club return to Brother Walfred's early days in the London borough of Tower Hamlets to deliver a 48-week a year programme of sports, arts and youth activities engaging young people at risk or involved with the criminal justice system, gangs or antisocial behaviour. If you ever fly into London City Airport, just as you get to the point where the massive buildings of Canary Wharf are on your left hand side, Poplar Harker's down there on the right. It is completely hemmed in, an island surrounded by the vast wealth of London. Hemmed in by the DLR, Docklands Light Railway, on one side, M4 Motorway, River Thames, etc. If you're wondering why East End of London, well, Brother Walfred was a headmaster in a school in the East End of London after forming Celtic, so it's keeping things strong. And a point that one of the speakers made, and certainly one that was I was thinking about on the very morning that I was heading to this event in the House of Commons, Scudamore of the English Premiership was defending the lack of community spend following the £5 billion TV contract, and his point was, well, these clubs were not formed as charities. Well, most of them are probably formed out of the communities within which they exist, and some don't need a £5 billion TV contract to stay true to their roots. Also, the Celtic Foundation are launching the 2015-1888 Charity Shield, sponsored by Ace Refrigeration, for the third year. It's a seven-a-side tournament, take place at Lennoxtown on Sunday, May the 31st. Tournament runs a Champions League style, with teams split into round-robin and qualifying groups. The victorious squad of 10 will be presented with a shield and medals in a day, and also receive a matchday experience at Celtic Park for an SPFL match date to be confirmed. The cost to enter a squad of 10 players into this year's 1888 Charity Shield is £1,000. Places first come, first served, etc. If you want to know more information, contact CFC Foundation at celticfc.co.uk or call 0141 551 4262. That's C for Charlie, F for Freddie, C for Celtic Foundation at celticfc.co.uk, 0141 551 4262. If you want to know about this or any of the events that Celtic FC Foundation are getting into, you can go to the CFC Foundation website or again call 551 4262. But that is enough of me. You've tuned into this for the Inter Milan stuff. So this is him, St Anthony, with him. Man who knows more about our history than most, Mr Pat Woods.
Today it's my great pleasure to be joined by the Celtic historian Pat Woods. Celtic and Inter Milan game is coming up, and we're here to discuss some of Pat's recollections and findings from the 1967 European Cup final between Celtic and Inter, which is obviously the most famous Celtic-Inter Milan game. So we're just going to have a wee recollection of the past. So as always, Pat, what was your first Celtic game and who was your first Celtic hero?
Well, my first Celtic game, I can't remember exactly where it was, what date it was. My earliest memory was Celtic games at Celtic Park, when being up on my father's shoulders in the jungle, bucket and rain that day. Mm-hmm. And I was sitting on top of watching the game, and suddenly this drip onto my head, and of course it was coming from the holes in the jungle roof, you know. Mm-hmm. That's my first memory.
What year would that have been, roughly?
Oh, early 50s. Early 50s, yeah.
And what's the first game that you would say that you can recall in detail? going to a game, is there any one game that stands out?
Nothing that stands out in particular. I mean, that was just a start of a routine of going to Celtic games. I can't remember any specific game, you know.
So what about in terms of hero then? Who was your first hero?
Big hero, but I think for all the schoolboys, because what used to happen in those days was my father used to clip me over the turnstile and we'd head up the nearest end to us coming from, we used to get a tram car from just outside our door in Shettleston where I stayed, the tram car, and the nearest end was a Rangers end. And we used to go in there and your father used to take you down, because I was just a wee smout and all that. But we used to take us down to the front, break down to the front of the terracing. And we used to think we were in it, you know.
In those days, the Rangers end wouldn't even have the roof, would it?
No, not at all.
And
no.
It was an old scoreboard behind the goal, wasn't it?
There was, yes, an old scoreboard, yeah. And where it was, the schoolboys watched it there, you were on the small side. Like I was, a wee smout, as they called it.
So as time passed on, you've been fortunate enough to see a lot of great players and great teams. Is there any particular favourite player you've had through the decades?
My first hero, you asked me about first hero, Bobby Evans. And I think he was every schoolboy's first hero. I mean, Bobby Evans just stood out. He seemed to be a dynamic player. Seemed to be everywhere on the pitch. Sometimes he seemed to be doing the work of 10 men. Of course, his red hair stood out. But yeah, he was my first hero, Bobby Evans.
And as time moved on, which players impressed you?
Well, the player that's most impressed me is Bobby Murdoch.
Funny, I was speaking to Michael Kelly last week, and he was waxing lyrical about Bobby Murdoch.
Yes, yeah, to me, it's a blend of power and skill. It's unique to any Celtic player I've seen. A great player and a great man as well to talk to.
I interviewed
him several times. I'm not utter gentleman. In fact, one of the saddest days of my life was I was going to the 2001 European Cup, the Champions League final, in Milan. And I was just about to set off for Paris. I was going to spend a few days in Barber. But he said, I had the radio and I heard the news of his death. I was absolutely devastated.
The irony of Bobby dying was he was the youngest of the lines.
He died so young.
You know, I know that things don't always work out like that, but it is sort of sad that the youngest went first.
Yeah.
I remember going to work that morning and I put the radio on to hear the sports headlines. I think it was Hugh Keevans and Radio Clyde. And it came on very somber. There wasn't any music. And you think, what's happening here? And he announced that Bobby had died. And I must admit to stopping the car I know it's an exaggeration and we probably shouldn't say it, but it felt like a death in the family.
Yeah.
Although I didn't know Bobby Murdoch and those Celtic fans, I suppose we are a family of sorts.
Yeah.
And when one of your own goes, then it's a dreadful feeling.
Well, that day, the rest of that day, I just couldn't get out of my mind. I really couldn't get out of my mind. Just run through my memories of him.
So, now, before we talk about Lisbon, I think for the younger listeners, it's hard to convey the misery of the late 50s and early 60s. I mean, I know when I was a kid and I was growing up, and I just thought that Celtic success took it for granted. And my dad used to tell me things like the 63 Cup final replay when we were hammered 3-0 through the Rangers, and a total embarrassment, to be honest. And then there's a couple of humorous anecdotes. The Celtic team in the days used to be referred to as Billy McNeil and Easy Beats.
Yes, I'll tell you how that came about after the final. What happened, I remember, during the game they were chanting, easy, easy, easy. Oh, it's horrible to listen to. You know, and of course, lots of Celtic fans left near the end, you couldn't blame them. It was such a dismal display.
And then the other thing as well is that there was a five-man forward line in the days, and they were referred to as the Five Sorrowful Mysteries.
Yeah, that actually was a bit earlier, in the 50s. That came about in the 50s, yeah. But you could call that the Five Sorrowful Mysteries and that day, because he just didn't turn up, really. And I remember at the end of that game, three friends were at the same school, St Paul's. We had been at St Paul's. And we left the ground, I handed him myself, my mate, Tommy McGinn, who stayed in the same clothes as me, and a guy called James Coleman, who was from Bark. And we walked all the way home from Hamden. And all we could talk about was, where is Celtic going from here? Where are they going to? Because you couldn't see any hope, really.
Well, they say it's always often darkest before the dawn. So a couple of years passed by, and Big Jock arrives in 1965. Was there anything when you heard the Jockstein's arrival? Was there anything to give you any indication of what was to come in terms of success?
Great hope, because I mean, I remember when I heard the news on the television, I just jumped for joy, because I knew he would make a change.
Mm.
I don't think there was many Celtic fans would have doubted that, you know, because I mean, you've got to understand the early 65, the Celtic support had become very apathetic,
mm-hmm.
simply because it was one disappointment after another. That's all it was. You couldn't see any hope. But he brought us a lot of hope, and more than that, you know.
The team is a bit of a mishmash as well. I mean, Murdoch was inside, right, which was a waste of talent. And Jimmy Johnson was nothing like the player he was to become. And even in a defensive sense, John Clark wasn't really a sweeper at that point. He was more of a half-back.
Yes.
So as soon as Steen went in there, it just took a bit of fine-tuning. And guys who looked, quite frankly, mediocre players all of a sudden found their niche and became went on to become great players.
Yeah, because I mean the big part of that was the American tour in 66, where he was able to experiment with an awful lot of ideas. And of course that's when the Murdoch and Old midfield partnership really came to fruition during that tour. And of course a great bonding tour. I mean every one of the players will tell you that.
Mm.
It's a very enjoyable tour.
So if I push on a wee bit to Lisbon then, or the road to Lisbon rather, I was talking to Roger Bailey a couple of weeks ago. Roger was a fascinating man to talk to, and I made the point that my dad, the night that Billy scored the winning goal against Fodge Van Dien in the last minute, my dad says that he felt it right there and then, that this was going to be, sometimes you just get a feeling this is going to be our year. Now Roger, funnily enough, surprised me and says that he followed the team, I think he's seen virtually every game that season, and he says that never at any time until they got to the final did he think that they could win it. So what about yourself? Was there a point during the season that you actually thought we were in with a chance of winning this?
Yeah, it was the Vojvodina game. Vojvodina
as well? Because
it was the drama surrounding it, you know, because at one stage it looked as if they weren't going to make it because they were so physically strong, technically good, and you just couldn't see a way through it, and the goalkeeper was wasting time, and you just felt it was going to be one of these nights.
The
drama came right at the very, very last minute, a typical last minute. Celtic came on, you know.
Well, the interesting thing was the in
those
days.
You've seen the way the crowd came out of Celtic Park that night.
Yeah, but like, funny.
Joy, people were jumping with joy. They really were.
I remember my dad saying that he was working a night shift and he had a pie and sandwiches in his pocket, and he says that when he got to his work after the game, the pie and the sandwiches had all mangled into one.
Yeah.
And I remember saying to him, what did you do? Did you throw it away? And he says, no, nothing ever tasted better than that night.
No.
He says, because of the feeling of euphoria.
Yes.
And the excitement that this is going to be special. You know, that something, we're on the verge of greatness.
Yeah.
And there was, as you said, they're coming out the stadium, you know, like, what a feeling that must have been.
And that was the time that Herrera had stated that Celtic were his biggest fear.
Mm.
Because they had played in the quarterfinals, they had played Real Madrid in the quarterfinals.
Mm-hmm.
And the French sports newspaper, L'Equipe, had a headline in the preview of the tie, and it said, the final before the final.
Mm-hmm.
That was a common view in Europe. That was a final before a final, Real Madrid and Inter Milan. And Inter won it so comfortable, they were established as favourites to win it.
That's right. And the thing as well is, it's worth bearing in mind that it was one each in aggregate going into the very last seconds of the game. If that game had finished a draw, it was a third, in those days,
Rotterdam,
it was a third game in Rotterdam.
Rotterdam,
which is a big difference for these days. You didn't have away goals and all that kind of thing. So it'd have been interesting to see how, thank God it didn't, but how it would have developed if a third game had taken place, but the outcome would have been.
Well, I mean, Jockstein said to John, to Sean Fallon on the bench, just as it was near time, when he said something like, it's bloody Rotterdam for us. They were a tough team to beat. They were hard as nails.
Mm. And a lot of the lines say that they were the hardest team on the way there.
Oh, I think you're right. Absolutely right,
So Celtic get to the final, and regarding yourself, I know that you were in Lisbon, so how did you get a ticket in the first place?
Well, you got it through SFA. Mm. You applied to SFA for a ticket. I've got the advert there. And you got the ticket, but my main concern at the time was where I was going to go to Lisbon, because I swithered about it because of the cost, the whole cost. And I spoke to a friend of mine, a colleague, a work colleague called Joe Hendry, who sadly died last year. We talked it over and he said, look, he says, if you don't go to this firm, you'll regret it for the rest of your life. That's what he said. I made up my mind.
Mm-hmm. And how did you get to Lisbon?
Well, I went the cheapest way, which was I got a bus from McGann Street, the overnight bus, Glasgow to London.
Mm-hmm.
And then we trained from Victoria, they called it the boat train in those days, the train and the ferry. Boat train from Victoria Station to the Gare du Nord in Paris. Mm-hmm. And then we had to get from the Gare du Nord to the Gare d'Orstal, which is in Paris. And then we get the train, it was called the Sud Express, which was anything but the Sud Express. But we got there.
Mm-hmm. And this would have took you through France into Spain, through the Pyrenees into
Yeah, and it was
Portugal.
The time, still the time of Franco's regime. Mm-hmm. And we got to the border at Irun, the Spanish border at Irun. You saw the soldiers with the guns over their shoulders. Yeah.
And who did you go yourself, or did you go with...
No, on the way I met people.
Oh, right, yeah, so
I met people on the bus.
Like-minded people.
Yeah, like-minded Celtic fans going to the game, yeah.
That must have been a great atmosphere, because I don't think we can portray... There's two things. I don't think we can portray the working class element amongst the support at that time, because I think these days you've got an element of... There is guys out there that are fairly wealthy these days that support Celtic, but you know, I think in the mid 1960s, it was very, the core support was very much the working class.
Yeah, very much so. Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Another thing as well is these are guys probably who had never been out of the country before.
Yeah, I had never been abroad. That's my first time.
That was your first time.
Yeah.
There might have been no guy in the army and that kind of thing, but obviously.
Yeah, that was my
war,
first. That was my first time abroad,
uh-huh,
and it was an adventure. It was like an adventure,
mm-hmm,
you know,
mm-hmm.
And it was also like a pilgrimage.
Mm-hmm.
When you got to Lisbon, Celtic support. Oh.
Everywhere.
Well, when I got there, I was struck immediately by the number of Celtic fans, because when I came out of the station, I heard Celtic fans singing. I said, well, this is good. And then you got on the tram, and then you saw how welcome the Portuguese people were. The people mm-hmm. of Lisbon were terrific, to us, I must say. They were really welcome Celtic. Mm-hmm. And you could see the PR battle had been won. And I later found out that very day, the day when I arrived in Lisbon, the day that both teams landed at Lisbon Airport,
mm-hmm.
and when I researched the game later on, I found out that the time I was arriving in Lisbon, when I could see the welcome that we were getting from these people, Inter had arrived, and their president, Angelo Moratti, when he arrived at Lisbon Airport, had gone to the airport lounge and started distributing free tickets and club badges to people just to try and drum up support for the final, because they'd lost it. They'd lost it because what happened was there was two or three things that went wrong for Inter. First of all, they didn't like Herrera.
Mm.
They didn't like his attitude, because he went on TV in Portugal and said that you know we want you to support us.
The Latin brothers
would stick together. But it was said in such a way, it was more like a kind of command and a request.
Mm-hmm.
So that didn't do it any well. The second thing was that people still had memories of the European Cup final 2 years earlier in Milan, which was played on Inter Milan's home ground at San Siro. But it said, and Benfica tried to change it, and UEFA said, if you don't fulfil your obligations to play this final, we'll give you one hefty fine.
Mm-hmm.
So they felt they were still angry about that then, and they lost the game too. The third thing was, they'd made no secret, Herrera, of the fact that he was very keen to get to take Eusebio, a magnificent player of Benfica, to Inter Milan. So, they'd lost the battle.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So the actual playing, the game was a dream for, not only for a Celtic point of view, but from the for a purist point of view. You know, the Catenaccio system, the dreaded Catenaccio system, that they had in place was torn apart.
Yeah.
And in some ways, I've heard it said, and I've read books that you've written as well, that they actually made it easier for Celtic in some ways.
They did. I think the turning point was the penalty goal. When Inter scored that penalty, if Celtic had tried to play their way back into the game, you know, try and just pass the ball about, try and just get themselves back into the game, I don't think they'd have won it. But immediately, the ferocity of the response, I definitely think that disconcerted Inter. And, you know, because Celtic just, you know, went straight into attack, gave them no peace whatsoever, took control of the game. Because Inter liked to, they liked to dictate, they were the one, they would have wanted to take the game from there on. maybe try and hit Celtic again. They weren't allowed to because Celtic forced them into defence.
Mm-hmm.
And Herrera spent the remainder of the first half trying to tell the Spurs to keep possession of the ball. Imagine that. Mm-hmm. I mean, nowadays, mm-hmm. we've got some not got a great reputation for keeping the ball. But he was pleading with them on the touchline, screaming and shouting, keep the ball, keep the ball. Mm-hmm. That's how much.
Couldn't
do anything about mm-hmm. it.
There's wonderful stories about that. I mean, it's like there are not so much stories now as myths that have grown through the years, and there's a story of the Celtic team standing in a tunnel, and the Milan players, players are they're tanned, they're good looking, they're athletes, they've got the best of gear, the hair's all swept back, they're like movie stars, and then you've got our lot who are peely wally looking, haven't been allowed to be in the sun. Ronnie Simpson's got false teeth in his bonnet because some of the players had false teeth at the time.
Yeah.
And it must have looked like a motley crew in comparison.
Yeah, well, it didn't immediately strike that when the teams came out because that to me was a spine tingling bit when the two teams came out because where I was, you could see just looking right down, you saw the two teams emerging.
Judging by Stevie Chalmers' goal, were you behind it or were you to the.
I was in line with Tommy Gemmell's goal.
Right.
Yeah, that's when you can judge where I was. I was right in line with the goal.
Adjacent to it?
No, right in line. Right in line with that. Yep. Uh-huh. And as I said, when the teams came out, I thought it was magnificent because you could see the two teams coming out from a distance. You could see them striding out, and Celtic on those green white hoops entering.
The contrast was terrific, wasn't it?
Great setting, and then the blue sky.
Mm-hmm.
I interviewed a guy who's at Lisbon, a journalist at Lisbon, a guy called Brian Butler.
Oh, the radio guy for Radio 2? He
worked for it, but he was, I think he was working for Daily Telegraph at the time in Lisbon.
Uh-huh.
Told me the story, he said when you arrived there at the stadium, he said it looked as if the decorators had been in, the interior decorators had been in, because it's all green and white.
Uh-huh.
White colonnade, you know that big marble colonnade?
Mm-hmm.
Lovely green, the trees surround it, just great for us.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And it was a unique setting for a final. It fits in with the special occasion for us winning it because it's there'll never be another sight like McNeil going up to that podium.
Most iconic photograph.
It's unbelievably brilliant looking and it's unique looking, and that image is one I'll live forever.
Yeah, I've seen more photographs of that presentation than I've seen of any other presentation in football history. It's a marvellous, isn't it? It just looks like Greek god there up and collecting the trophy. Wonderful.
So as a fan and you're watching the game in Lisbon, was there ever a time that you worried or you fretted that it wasn't going to turn out right?
Yeah, because first of all you felt the tension. Once the teams had come out, great spine tingling to see them coming out. It's just as we get the kick off, you feel the tension.
Mm-hmm.
You just hope they're not going to let you down, and then we get the penalty. It was a sickener, no doubt about it. It was a real sickener. But it was heartening to see the way they went, but they fought back.
Mm-hmm.
But as the time wore on in the second half, you can't worry, because for all the pressures, after the game, Saturday's display was such that Jock Stein said that the result could have been 6-1.
Well, he was seen as a weak link.
Which is ironic
given the fact that he was the man of the match in Milan terms.
Yeah. But he definitely was. Mm-hmm. I think it would have been about 6-1.
Mm-hmm.
Saves he made.
There's also an irony as well that Joe McBride was Celtic's top forward and he scored all those goals right up to the new year and then he got his injury.
Yeah.
And if Joe had been fit, probably Stevie Chalmers wouldn't have started in Lisbon.
Quite possible.
Possibly, but the way things might have worked out.
Yeah.
And yet Chalmers is the guy who'll be remembered forevermore as getting the winning goal.
Not just that, he was central to Celtic's tactics because he wasn't played as an orthodox centre-forward. Because the idea that Steen had was to get him to take players out of position with his running power. And same with a couple of other players, would take them out of position. And the idea was to draw the Inter Milan players out of position to allow the people with the strong shots like Murdoch and Gemmell to come through.
And that's how we evolved.
But Steen's education, football education, had really started in 1953 at Wembley when he went, Celtic Park had been down to see Hungary play, beat England 6-3. And he realised watching that day the game had changed. The British were far behind the Continentals.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things, the far behind, you noticed the deep line centre forward.
Mm-hmm.
The guy who wasn't orthodox centre forward, the guy who could step, you know.
Was that Hiddegutti?
Hiddegutti, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So the you know, like, the time wears on and Celtic are grinding them down.
Yeah.
And then we get the winning goal. I mean, yeah. it sounds like an obvious question, but describe how what the feeling was when that went in.
Well, tremendous. Yeah. But I'll tell you something about the presser. The worry was that as time was wearing on, a couple of Continental papers made the observation that they felt Celtic were near breaking point. That how long could they go on trying to get this equaliser?
Mm.
So what a relief it was when Tommy scored.
The fitness aspect's got to come into
the
well,
fitness and stamina were central to it.
When you watch it in the 90 minutes,
yeah,
and you're playing it at the biggest game in the continent, and to see that level of fitness in the heat of Lisbon and to carry that out for 90 minutes, it speaks volumes for the fitness.
Yeah, if you saw Saturday's training sessions, you would have been surprised. I once saw one of his training sessions, standing there like a ringmaster, running things, and the emphasis was on fitness. And they were, I reckon, the fittest team in Europe.
Yeah, they would have been. It says a lot for them.
Yeah.
And then the final whistle goes and...
Yeah.
And you know, did you run in the park? Did you go over the moat?
No, I didn't go over the moat, no. No, that wasn't my style.
Were you tempted?
No, never. No. I'd just wait to see the presentation and then go and get celebrated.
Well, you were talking earlier on there about Franco, you know, being a fascist dictator and the police with the guns in Spain. I mean, Salazar was in charge in Portugal as well, right? And he wasn't a shrinking violet when it came to things.
Yeah.
And it's great, actually, that the police appreciated the fact that although we did run in the park, it was good-natured stuff, and it was boisterous, but it wasn't there was no aggression, there was no threat, there wasn't a violent invasion.
Yeah.
And, you know, when you compare that to what happened in Barcelona in 72 with Rangers, And that speaks volumes for the contrast between the supporters. But it's when you see it, I always think, somebody said to me one day that how would you describe Celtic's Irish-Scottish relationship? And I remember being a wee boy and I was always stuck with the image of a guy standing in a moat with a kilt with an Irish tricolour.
Yes,
and if somebody asked me to describe it, that is it.
Yes.
Because the guy with the kilt on had an Irish flag and that describes perfectly what the relationship between Ireland and Scotland means as Celtic fans.
Yeah, yeah, oh yeah. And I'll tell you something, the chief of police in Lisbon had promised a few days before the violence that we'll take care of this.
Mm.
We are well equipped to deal with any problems. Mm. Of course, Great Wall of China couldn't get it off that. Crossing over the moat or even get access to the dressing room, access to the dressing room as well.
Mm. Well, Roger Bailey, when I was speaking to him, he said, I don't know if he actually got it on the tape, but he said to me that one of his most memorable moments, and God, Roger's got so many things to choose from, he says, I was actually standing next to Jock Stein in the dressing room, which is Bedlam, by the way. There was all sorts of people in there, and the next thing, that the door gets kicked open there shyly, and he says the immortal words, well, he said, Jock, you're immortal.
Yes.
And Roger Bailey says, I witnessed that, and word for word. And he says, Shankly is the kind of guy that he says that when he kicked the door open, everybody stopped what they were doing, because that man had presence.
Oh, he definitely did.
He says, and he just summed it up brilliantly with one sentence, on the spot, how everybody was feeling.
Yeah.
And he was the only English manager that took the trouble to go also.
Yeah, oh yeah. Well, he'd been fascinated by the personality of the postmanager. That's what he said, that's why he was going. He took an Italian paper, newspaper, that's why I want to go. He says, because these two guys hate losing. Hate losing. That's a fascinating game, he says.
I know that you've done a lot of documentation through the years and all that. Like, what was the... I don't think you need to be a genius to work out what reaction Inter would have got back in Italy when they returned.
Well, they got, from their own fans, they got a good reaction. They got a sympathetic reaction.
Mm.
It's quite sad their return, because on the way back, the President Moratti got into a confrontation with a radio journalist. You know, that was one aspect. And when they actually arrived back at Lisbon Airport, two of the women in the party were in tears. One of them was with a wife of one of the players, and the other one was a fiance of one of the players. They were tears when they landed at airport.
Because of the...
Yeah.
Because of what they were facing when they went back?
No, not because of what they were facing, they were just so disappointed.
Oh, right, the disappointment.
Yeah,
well,
they were when they got back, yeah. Oh. Yeah. There was no... I mean, it was nothing like what happened to the Italian team at return from the World Cup.
No.
When they get pelted with tomatoes, they went back and they get the terrible abuse. No, their fans welcome them back, yeah.
There's a lovely story about the Inter Milan party when they're travelling back, they're in the airport waiting to go back to Italy.
Yeah.
And they see the airport's full of Celtic fans.
Yeah.
And Sarti being the man of the match, the guy that impressed the Celtic fans most, there was a wee boy there and his dad gave him a Celtic scarf, and he ran up to Sarri and gave him the scarf. I think Inter Milan players were apprehensive that they were going to get a bad reception with the Celtic fans, but apparently the Celtic fans applauded him into the airport.
They did indeed, yeah.
Which was a wonderful gesture. Yeah. And this wee boy ran up with a scarf and he gave it to Sarri, and Sarri took off his club tie and his lapel badge and gave it to the wee boy.
Yeah.
And that's a great example, I think, of the reason that continental football, European football, was there in the first place, was to foster good relationships between countries.
Yeah.
And I think we lose sight of that now because it's such a big tournament, it's all about money. But in those days, there was an emphasis put on the camaraderie and the friendliness between the opposition.
Oh, yeah. There's another story which was in the Italian paper at airport when they were returning at Lisbon Airport, when the fans were milling about the lounge. One of them went up to Sandro Mazzola and said to him, "Look, Sandro, could I have your tie? You know, a souvenir," and he managed to communicate that because obviously the guy didn't speak Italian, but he managed to communicate every point and all that sort of stuff. And Sandro, "Oh, I can't do that because we've got to keep our uniform." And he says, "Oh, yes." And so this guy kept on pleading with him. And eventually Sandro said, "All right, there you are," and handed it over. Good day, so they handed it over, you know.
Well, that sums up the feeling of the time between the fostering good relationships between the fans.
Yeah.
So then. But okay, you've got there in Lisbon, and on the way home, did you go the same route that you would have came? Did you follow it faithfully all the way back?
Yeah, this time I got the train all the way back to Glasgow from Euston.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And is it fair to say that the return journey was more lively than maybe coming out the way?
Oh, it was fun. Yeah, I mean, what the most significant part of that journey home was when we arrived in Paris. Now, when we were going out through Paris, nobody took any notice. We had bags and scarves, they didn't bother us. But on the way back, it was a different matter, because when we got off the train at the Gare d'Austerlitz, and on our way through Paris back up to Gare du Nord, people going like, Celtic, they knew who you were. So, and that's the power of television.
Definitely.
Because what Steen had realised, I think, more than anything else, I think he knew more than anybody else was what winning that final would have meant to Celtic.
Yeah.
The power of television.
Because
this was the first time Celtic were shown Europe-wide in television live.
Mm-hmm.
That's a fact.
Did you hang about Lisbon for a wee bit afterwards?
Yeah, I didn't come back to Sunday.
Right, and what kind of... Oh, was it euphoric?
Great. It was like walking in air.
Mm-hmm.
Walking in air. And one sad aspect of it was the fact that... I lost my friend's scarf.
Oh.
I'd borrowed this scarf from a friend, Tom McGinn, who's lived up the same close as me. I'd borrowed his scarf, and it was a silk scarf. Tassels, different from mine. I had one of the cloth scarves
the 60s type,
but he'd a silk one,
mm-hmm.
and I borrowed it. The day after the final, I'm walking down the street in Lisbon. Just one sudden along, feels this tug at the back of my neck because I had it over my shoulders.
Mm.
Turns around, a wee boy, we run away a bit.
A wee urchin.
Uh-huh. So I would never have caught him anyway. And that attitude was, what the hell? You know, that was my attitude.
Mm-hmm.
So I once again, I apologise, he told me. Mm-hmm. If he's listening to us, I apologise. Yeah.
Funny thing is, if the wee guy had asked, you'd have given him something.
Oh, right. Well, she'd already given away badges. Mm-hmm. Took some badges with me to give away.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So then, there's a story, I think you would back this up. I can't remember where I heard this. It was a guy who went by train and planned his route. And as I said there, he went through France, into Spain, Pyrenees, into Portugal. And he says when he was going there, I think you've alluded to it a wee bit there, and he says that, you know, people were a wee bit mystified. Who are these green and white people? That's what's going on here? And then on the way back, he said that he didn't need to buy food or drink because everybody was just like treating him like a celebrity.
Yeah.
And again, that's the TV thing there. That's
TV. Yeah, he realised that.
Live television throughout the continent overnight. Yes. And the Celtic and the players became household names.
Yeah, people were so impressed with the way they played. And by the way, talking about, the travel, an awful lot of people hitchhiked.
Mm.
It's not known that, you don't see much mention of that. My friend Tommy Conn, who I met in Lisbon, that's the first time I met Lisbon in Lisbon for that final, he had he'd taken a shellfish lorry from Eyemouth, where he stayed, down to Southampton. He got a lift in that, down to Southampton. And then he crossed to the other side, he got a lift from Cherbourg all the way to Lisbon.
He was lucky.
Yep. And there was two other interesting cases. There was a case of two young lads who got a lift by a French lady, and when she took them as far as she could take them, she then insisted, she so much enjoyed her company, good laugh, that she insisted on buying my meal.
Well, that's nice. So stories like that make it special.
And the other one was, it was a Belgian TV commentator. He decided to drive down to Lisbon, take his time going down there, and she was astonished at the number of hitchhiking Celtic fans.
Mm.
Yeah. You don't hear so much about it.
No, I don't think people would hitchhike so readily these days, but
no,
it's different.
No, in those days,
yeah. But the other thing that it's ironic is that we're perceived as being the Catholic club, and we won the European Cup in a holiday of obligation.
Yeah.
But it was, I think, off the top of my head, I think it was Ascension Thursday, and I remember Jockstein had made jokes about like getting a cut of the plate and things churches. But you know that
he got in such a relaxed mood, that was a big factor. Uh-huh. They were relaxed.
Mm-hmm.
You know, whereas Inter were in a bit of a state by that time.
Mm.
Because they were struggling in the championship. And it was a club that was out of sorts because the players were fed up Herrera.
Mm.
Because by this time he'd stepped up the training, which didn't go down too well. And the other thing was that their hotel, our headquarters in Lisbon, was such that he kept them cooped up in it.
Mm.
Didn't let them out, virtually. It was like it became a prison camp.
Mm-hmm.
Despite the pleadings with his captain, Peaky, Armando Peaky, pleaded with him not to this training, you're stepping up with this training too much, at this time of the season. And they said, well, we've got to get out of this hotel. No.
Mm-hmm.
He's a very unbending man at times, Herrera. You know? Mm-hmm. But don't get me wrong, he was a highly innovative coach.
Well, was his reputation damaged after that?
Oh, I think it was.
It was never the same, was it?
Never the same. He was a highly innovative coach because he was the first coach to blend the technical, the tactical, the medical and the psychological aspects of football, to integrate them all.
Ahead of his time.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And what he also was responsible for was the first club to build up a supporters' clubs.
Mm-hmm. So Gerry McNee once said that there was four world class players in the Lions.
Yeah.
It was Murdoch, Tommy Gemmell, Jinky and Bertie Auld.
Yeah.
Do you think that's a fair assessment? Or has he been a wee bit cruel to the other guys maybe they're not getting mentioned?
Well, I think that's the way it generally is, isn't it? But the important thing is, whether world class or not, it was a team effort.
Mm-hmm.
And the players you singled out, I'd be the first to acknowledge that the others played as big a part as they did.
Mm-hmm.
It was very much, because Steen insisted on that team ethic. The team ethic.
Mm. The other thing that used to fascinate me as a kid when I watched
it. And I'll tell you something, I think their biggest strength was their gallousness. When they were going to the ground on the day of the match in the bus, and you remember the bus got lost,
mm-hmm.
and some people were threatening all that. Players were just bantering away, singing songs, and the two people on the coach who were from Lonks FC, who served up in the early round, the club had been so impressed, Bob Kerr had been so impressed with hospitality, that they invited him along as guests, and they're sitting in this bus. They've seen us. And they're going to play a European Cup final.
Mm-hmm.
They're astonished at this.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. It's gone down to much more disciplined. You know, they'd be sitting there. You know, would dream of doing that.
I remember reading Brian Clough's book, and he says that part of the balance of being a manager is obviously you want to have the players in a ready state of mind.
Yeah.
But he says before some big games, he says you've got to lighten the mood. He says it's often a good thing to tell a joke or get a laugh at somebody's expense to let everybody release a wee bit of tension.
Yeah.
You know, so I think Steen would have been good at that as well.
Oh, he was, yeah. I mean the whole scene just seems set for a Celtic victory. You just had that feeling in Lisbon that they were going to win it.
Mm-hmm.
It was just...
Did you get back in time for the bus coming on Celtic Park?
No, because I didn't come back to Sunday, yeah. I missed that, yeah.
Now, moving on a wee bit, because you are, if there is such a thing as a Celtic historian, I think most people would point to yourself, and you've collected and researched a load of material, particularly from Lisbon. Is there anything that stands out in terms of the stories or research, anything unusual?
I wouldn't say it stands out. I just enjoy gathering information on it.
Mm.
It's enjoyable because I've got most of my information in the Bibliothèque Nationale in Paris, because I go to Paris at least once a year. It's my favourite city, and the favourite city after going through there to Lisbon.
Mm.
And I go there at least once a year, and I go to Bibliothèque, which is a magnificent institution.
Mm. Is this the sort of library that's got every publication?
It's a national library. It's got an amazing range of papers from all parts of Europe.
Mm-hmm.
Unbelievable. It's a superb library, great atmosphere to do research in, good cafes and everything, you know, you can just sit there, you feel very much at ease, great service, staff are magnificent, and you know, you get these papers and you just come there and you see it.
So that this is the mid-60s, but this time the media spotlight is there and Celtic are overnight sensations.
Yeah.
And not only in terms of the television, but in the papers as well.
Well, don't forget, they come from the margins of football within the space of, just over 2 years. Unbelievable. It's centre stage.
So, you brought out the book One Afternoon in Lisbon, which is a wonderful, wonderfully written story of not only of the final, but the build-up, the season, round by round, and conveying the excitement along the way, and you'd have been fortunate enough to speak to all the players at that point.
With myself and Kevin McCarr interviewed players, yeah.
And this would have been maybe about 20 years after Lisbon.
Yeah.
What kind of feeling did you get for the players? I mean, was the recollection fresh?
Oh yeah, still fresh in their minds, yeah. Very much so, yeah.
Mm.
Of course, at that time, we couldn't, there was no access to, there was no internet, no eBay, you had no access to foreign papers. So what we were doing was fundamentally a British British viewpoint at the time, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And that's just why I decided, why I decided to go to Bibliothèque Nationale when I was going to Paris was because when the internet came in, and particularly eBay, and buying things, I began to get curious of buying things. It was a lot of the stuff you'll see here. I began to get curious about other newspapers and magazines were saying about Celtic, and that's why I decided to do it.
So what kind of countries of newspapers have you researched?
Oh, umpteen papers. You could get it. I got it at Bibliothèque Nationale. Portugal, France, Spain, Belgium, Italy, you name it. Luxembourg.
And what about
Malta?
Is it translation?
Malta Times. No, I just get photocopies and I just translate them when I go home. I've got a good working knowledge of French and Italian. And of course, you've got the Google, you can do them in the Google as well.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
That's good. So, is there scope for more, another book in Lisbon? Has every story come out, or do you think that there's another angle to be?
Well, you never know. You never know what turns up. You know, I'm sure there is other stuff. It's one of the most fascinating finals of all time.
Oh, definitely.
You know what I mean? When you think about it, I mean, the first British club to win it, the first Northern European club to win it, and the circumstances in which they win it.
It was a sense of underdog as well.
Sense of underdog, and because don't forget, it had been a sort of private battle between three cities, essentially. Mm-hmm. I mean, the three cities that won it would have been Madrid, Lisbon and Milan.
Milan, that's right. And did you get to Milan in 1970?
Yeah.
And
oh, that was a massive disappointment.
Well, the way I describe it is it's like a bad secret in the family. It's the kind of thing. I remember being a wee boy and saying to my dad, what's this European Cup final? He's fine. Or he's like, oh, don't want to talk about that. You know, all the tales of Lisbon had been told and you know, trying to get information off somebody when you were a boy about Feyenoord, nobody wanted to talk about it. It was like...
it was a dark secret.
It was having an uncle who...
Deep disappointment.
Yeah. And the sense of underdog, we lost that because... Yeah. It was almost like the reverse.
It was very much the reverse, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
They played very well that night. Yeah. Mm-hmm. They couldn't argue with the result.
And you'd have been in Seville as well?
Yes, I was
so
in Seville.
You're one of the few guys that's got the full collection?
Yes, yeah.
Well, hopefully in the years to come, maybe there'll be a fourth one. That would be nice.
Yeah.
So, moving on a wee bit again regarding the books, you're probably best remembered for the Gloriny Dream book that came out in 87, 88.
Yeah.
And it's regarded as a quintessential history. Certainly at that time it was anyway. And there was a wee bit of controversy about the date of the club's inception.
Yes, right.
So, do you want to explain that?
Well, I mean, I had evidence that they were formed in that meeting at
November.
Constituted a constitution. Yeah. Well, to me, once you've got a constitution, you're formed, mm-hmm. aren't you? You're founded. Mm-hmm. Of course, Celtic disagreed. They took it from basically their first match.
Because there's a funny thing.
Don't forget, after 87, the media is... leased the ground,
right?
They started building the ground.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
Well, there's a funny thing regarding the old Rangers because...
Yeah.
It was certainly when I was a boy, it was 1873.
Yeah.
And yet, for some unknown reason, in the last few years, they keep claiming their history has been 1872.
Yeah, it's 1872.
It must be somebody... Yeah. You know, it's funny how the club had it as 1873.
It happens with a lot of clubs. Yeah.
And the other thing as well is that your book came out maybe just before Brian Wilson's official centenary book.
Yeah.
Was there a friction between the two?
Our book came out first. Mm-hmm. Ours was the first book, no.
But Celtic didn't take your book though, did they?
Yeah, they weren't happy about it.
Mm-hmm. That's what I mean.
Particularly over the business of the day.
Yeah. And when you say they were unhappy, what was their argument?
Well, they disputed. I think the main arguments about the dispute was about the date of the founding. Because,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I mean, don't forget, they would have 1880 up in their stand and all their literature and all that, you know.
I suppose their argument is they're taking it for the first game rather than...
Well, I assume they take it for the first game in 1888, yeah.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And what did you think of Brian Wilson's book?
Yeah, it was a good book, yeah.
Mm.
Yeah.
Well, I remember being a bit disappointed, I thought, with the... what he had at his disposal, and you know that he said that he had the records, the board records or board minutes rather, going way back and things like that, and I remember before it being excited about what it would be, and yet in it that there's very little evidence of that. He doesn't really use his what was available to him.
Well, you know, it's the author shapes the book, you know, it's up to him the way he shapes the book.
I think the best way to describe it is he played safe.
No, I wouldn't say played safe. I think. You write the book, you know, as it comes to you know what I mean? You can't, I mean, you just got to stand by the book once you've brought it out.
So of all the books that you've had about Celtic, is there one that stands out to your favourite?
I've enjoyed them all, doing them all.
Equally?
Yeah, because frankly, if I didn't enjoy doing the books, I wouldn't.
You didn't do it?
And I'd stop doing it, no matter how late the stage. If I stopped enjoying doing the book, I'd stop it.
Mm-hmm.
That's it.
So how many have you done now?
About 10, I think.
10?
Yeah.
And is there any more in the pipeline?
Might be, you never know.
Is there a particular topic that you've had a wee inclination to write about that you've not done yet, but it's a wee desire?
Well, nothing really. No, I mean, they might do another... I mean, I've got the Jim Craig book. We could do it with Jim Craig. Might do a sort of... follow up to that, perhaps, you never know.
Is that the Jim Craig book that finished at 67?
No, the one I did with him recently.
Oh, right.
Yeah. Celtic Pride and Passion.
Right. I'm getting confused with the one Jim Craig brought out, himself. So the forthcoming game against Inter's coming up.
Yeah.
And it's certainly that part of the reason we're having this podcast is it brings back the memories, and for every Celtic fan, Inter Milan's always going to have a special place in your heart. So how do you think we'll fare against Inter?
Well, it's, Inter have been struggling recently. But you never know in the night. It's, they could reproduce a form, you know. Mm.
Do you fancy an art trip to the San Siro?
No.
And of the current Celtic team at the moment, I think it's fair to say there was teething problems in the beginning, but since the new year, we touched wood, we seem to have turned a wee corner. And what's your opinion of the current team?
Well, it's hard to tell because I don't go to the games now. I just watch
the telly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but certainly from what I read, certainly I think there's re-signing of Commons is a good idea. Mm-hmm. I think that was important.
Well, the two new guys as well, quite impressive debuts in the Wednesday night against Partick Thistle, so the hope is that they'll bed in as well and make these even stronger.
Yeah, I mean, I think that the Inter Milan game will define their season to a great extent.
Yeah,
I know
they're
going for the treble, but I think, you know, I think that will be a defining moment for Celtic.
Mm-hmm.
So that, you know, how they fare against Inter Milan.
It's kind of funny
because not just because of the 67, but because how you see yourself in Europe.
It's kind of funny how we were talking there about Steen and Celtic being the fittest team in Europe. Dial has put a lot of emphasis on fitness in the current team.
Yeah.
And I have to admit to being a wee bit annoyed earlier in the season because I felt that was a bit of a red herring to cover up for deficiencies in other areas. But I do have to say that since the new year, especially, as I said, they seem to have turned a wee corner, the fitness in that Celtic team is tremendous.
Well, I think fitness is very important and pace is very important now in football. I mean, because don't forget that Celtic team and also pace up front, particularly Bobby Lennox.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, that was very important.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think important ingredients now, you can see it's very much more so in modern football, pace.
That's right, but when you look about the Celtic team at the moment, they seem to have pace in every area. Even the two centre-backs, they're athletes.
Yeah,
you know, they're no big cumbersome lumbering centre backs maybe that we've had in previous generations. These guys are technically good. They're good, big strong boys, but at the same time they can shift as well. Very impressive.
Well, it's very important. I mean, movement off the ball is important because Steen was very insistent upon that.
Mm-hmm.
His motivation was the creation of space and movement off the ball. That was very crucial to him.
Mm-hmm. And of the did you go on any other travels? I know that you were in the three finals. Did you go travel to any of the away games in the halcyon days of the 60s?
I went to St Etienne.
We lost that night, didn't we?
Yeah, in St Etienne, yep. Yeah, they were pretty lucky to get away with just 2-0. And they retrieved it at Parkhead. They were pretty lucky that night because a guy called Keita, Salif Keita, played for, and he ran rings around sort of defence.
The African guy? Anybody else?
Try to think now.
Amsterdam 71?
Oh yes, Amsterdam 71, yes. Mm. That was a real disappointment, yeah.
Mm.
The roof fell in the last 20 minutes there.
Yeah. I think if there's one galling thing that you know, we are remembered, we revere the Lisbon Lions and the European Cup win, but, you know, it could have been more as well. I mean, we blew it against Feyenoord in 1970, and it was also the two semi-finals in 72 and 74. We lost very narrowly in different circumstances.
Yeah.
But the, you know, to have won it once is terrific. But we really could have been a mega club at one point. We could have won 3 or 4.
We missed a chance in Milan against Feyenoord. There's no question about that.
Mm-hmm.
There's no question about that. I mean, the 72 match, it came down to a lottery at the end and the penalty kicks.
Yeah, yeah.
But they were so consistent with the penalties.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't miss a single penalty.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, in 74, Celtic weren't really given a chance to play, were they?
Atletico
were just brutal, absolutely brutal.
74,
that to my mind, they should have been put out of the competition.
I think if that happened these days, there would be an outcry to have them barred for a considerable period.
Yeah.
But the 74, I remember being at the game and my dad being sort of. Madrid was like a glamour name, and when you heard Madrid, you thought of Puskas and Di Stefano and these great players, and the reputation that Real Madrid had built up, Atletico were intent and not hell at it.
Yeah, and I mean the thing is that, you know, when you look at Atletico, I've got to remember that Steen, I think Jock Steen, although Celtic made a protest to UEFA and tried to get the game switched from Madrid, they wanted it in a neutral venue. I think Jock Steen knew because he was constitutionally suspicious of UEFA. Because after the final in Lisbon at the banquet, he overheard a UEFA official sympathising with Inter Milan. Because due to the absence of Suarez and Jair, and he was very angry about it, and upbraided a UEFA official. Why don't you just give us credit? He was very angry about that.
Well, he's been a bit ignorant as well, because we were missing Joe McBride.
That was, and not only that, as Steen pointed out, they had been out of form. Although they were injured, they had been out of form even when they were fit. They'd struggled.
Some of the players at the time, I mean, I don't think John Hughes ever recovered from no playing in Lisbon. That must have been a terrific disappointment.
That would be a disappointment,
And Joe as well. I think Joe accepted it more because it was a long-term injury and he knew long before it that he wasn't going to make it, whereas Yogi was in the team up until maybe 3 weeks beforehand.
Yes, after the Dukla game.
That must have been Willie O'Neill and...
It's just a good squad, didn't it?
Well, it's worth pointing out that my idea of the Lisbon Lions isn't the 11 guys.
No, you know, it was a squad. It was a squad of about 15, 16 players.
Definitely. You know, you've John Fallon, Willie O'Neill, Charlie Gallagher, John Hughes, Joe McBride.
Yeah.
They deserve the title of Lisbon Lions as well.
I mean, it was a very good squad Celtic had. It was very important to have it too. Because one of the things that Herrera was accused of after the final was, what I remember reading the Italian paper, that said he'd failed to manage the season. And what they meant by that was, we now call it squad rotation.
Yeah.
Right. But he hadn't rotated the squad properly, he hadn't rested players when he needed rest, and he criticised his transfer policy. So they reckoned up that Inter had run out of gas roughly towards the end of the season because he hadn't managed it properly. You know? But Steen had managed it.
And it's also difficult to, between the years of 66, probably, and maybe even 76, our standing in Europe was terrific. I mean, we were one of the teams in Europe in the way that you see these glamour guys these days. And I think that...
Well, I mean, in 1969, when AC Milan came to Parkhead, there'd been nothing each over there. Their manager, Nerio Rocco, was their coach. He hinted to his directors... They would lose 3-0 Parkhead.
Really?
Yeah. Yep. And you remember that was an eight to they won 1-0 to Pratty.
Well, big Billy made an error that night, so either.
Well, that was it.
It wasn't a great throw in either, I have to say.
Well, but Celtic lost that game. People in Italy thought that Celtic were certain to win it.
Paolo Maldini's dad was in the management of AC Milan at that time.
Yeah.
And I remember reading a magazine or a book. And he said that they beat Celtic in the quarterfinals.
Yeah.
They beat Real Madrid in the semi-finals. No, Man United in the semi-finals.
Right.
And then they beat Ajax in the final.
Yeah.
And he said that they knew as soon as they beat Celtic in the quarterfinals that was it. There wasn't another team stopping them. So it proved, because they beat United fairly convincingly and they won 4-1 in the final against Ajax.
Yes. Yeah.
So again, it's an indication of our standing in the game at that time.
Yeah.
But I think the sad thing these days is that the Champions League becomes such a cartel for the Spanish, the Italians, the English, the Germans.
It's a rich man's club now, really.
That you know, and they all, even teams with even bigger pedigrees than us. You think the Ajax, and you're thinking about Benfica, and great names.
Oh, great names at the time. Oh, yeah, these were tremendous.
And they're getting diluted now because they're playing smaller leagues and they're getting marginalised.
You know, very much so.
UEFA they need to come up with something because. European football wasn't meant to be a cartel. It was meant to be like a sharing. It was meant to be like for everybody's enjoyment. And certainly these days, you could virtually name the last 16 the Champions League at the beginning. You could name 14 of them, 15 right away. There's always maybe one wee surprise that crops up.
Yeah.
Ourselves have been a case in point a couple of seasons, but it's disappointing. It's became like that.
It's very disappointing. Yeah, because that was a much more democratic competition in the early days. You know, I mean, the fact that a team from Scotland could have a chance, winning a competition, you could never conceive of that now. But unfortunately, it's very sad. There's no doubt about it because more and more, I mean, see what's happened in England being bought over by
obscene money.
Yeah, obscene money. Yeah, totally different now.
So that basically brings us to the end part. The only thing I would like to ask you is, Of your time in Lisbon, travelling and watching the game, it might sound obvious to say it, but what's the outstanding memory, if there's one outstanding memory?
I wouldn't say it was an outstanding memory. There were three or four things you remember. I remember my outstanding memory is, well, apart from the match itself, the whole atmosphere, the great welcome we got from Portuguese people, which is a big factor, I think, in Celtic's match, because they didn't just welcome us there. There's a great number of them were supporters at the stadium. Meeting now, Tommy Collins, the guy who hitchhiked from Ibiza, that's where I met him.
So when you're lying in bed in a cold night and you shut your eyes, you can still see Big Billy lifting the cup?
I can still see Big Billy lifting the cup, can still see teams coming out. That was a fabulous memory, just see it, because you're far from home, first time you've seen a club abroad. It was a fantastic memory.
Now, who knows, maybe in one day.
I mean, to see Big Billy, I mean, that as I said, is the most iconic presentation.
That's what you call a captain.
Oh, yeah.
Well, hopefully one day,
And I mean, the other memory I've got is, was when I was leaving to go to Lisbon, my mother saying to me, keep an eye out for you in the crowd, son.
What age would you be in Lisbon?
The day of the final itself, I was, let's see now, May the 25th, my birthday was the 1st of June. It was a week before my 21st birthday.
Oh, so that's...
Yeah. And a disappointment about Lisbon, by the way, I'll tell you about it, was the trophy itself, because the day before the final, they were selling replicas of the cup, right? And we kind of feel bottom near the old cup. Little did we realise
that the cup trophy.
And by the way, happy to you. If you even the Scottish paper, you look at a lot of Scottish papers and continental papers, and the previous ones still had the old cup.
So we were arguing about the first ones to win the new trophy.
We were the first ones. Yeah. But I mean, nobody seemed to realise it.
That's right.
You know? But I was disappointed. I was coming back with the wrong trophy, as a lot of people were. I'm sure a lot of people must have got a surprise.
That's right. Well, hope springs eternal. You never know. Maybe one day we'll get back to the heady hits, and Ronnie Dyle will lead us to glory in a couple of seasons' time. Fingers crossed.
You never know. I would like to see. I would definitely like to see a more democratic tournament. Competition. Definitely, because I mean that. European Cup to me means all Europe, not just the major countries.
So that about finishes it, Pat. I just want to thank you for your time going down memory lane. It's been really enjoyable. And
it's been a pleasure.
Wish you all the best for the future.
Yeah, same to you. All the best. Thanks.
I hope you enjoyed that interview with St Anthony on Pat Woods. I cannot wait till Thursday night. It's going to be special, and I can't wait for Ronnie's roar at the end after we've won out 4-0 victors. If only. Here's hoping. This is me, Harry Brady. That was him, St Anthony, with him, Pat Woods, saying goodnight. Goodnight.